Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Second hour of today's show, we are going to be talking about Ebola. We are going to be considering a number of aspects of the pandemic. Whatever you may want to say about it, it is certainly an incredibly dominant theme in the news at the moment. I have a lot of concerns about the validity of what we've been told about this illness. I have great concerns about the way it is sort of being used to hype up a state of kind of collective hysteria, which, as we've seen so with so many different things that have happened over the years, that when this sort of thing is manipulated to such a degree, there are a variety of agendas behind it. Now, I don't want to come across as any kind of expert on this topic, and I don't want to say to you that this is a hoax. And a lot of people are saying it's a hoax, and there's a lot of, you know, alternative talk in some aspects of the media that this is a hoax, but then a lot of the alternative media are completely more or less in agreement with the mainstream sort of narrative of what Ebola is. I simply want to today to consider a different perspective, and I have a guest on the line, John Rappaport, who is a journalist with a long history of research into very, very controversial medical topics. John wrote a book about HIV and AIDS that explores the problems with the definition of AIDS, the problems with the definition of AIDS being caused by the HIV virus. It's a very, very complex and perplexing topic, which many people find too hard to even to engage with, because it just completely challenges everything that we've been told. So I'd just like to welcome to the show John Rappaport. John, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good to be here.
Absolutely. Really, really great to have you on board the show today. John, you've written articles on many topics for magazines like LA Weekly, Spin Magazine, Village Voice, and you've written on the questions about human health, about problems with the definitions of viruses, and problems about the way we understand human illness. The germ theory is something you have questioned in principle, which is a very, very deep challenge to the medical paradigms within which we live. Could we just start maybe talking a little bit about that, and we can expand in various directions?
Sure. Well, as everybody knows, modern medicine, as it is practiced, relies completely on the germ theory of disease. In other words, a germ enters the body, the person becomes ill. Another germ enters another person's body, and that person becomes ill in some other way. And this, of course, allows for all of the treatments that we see in modern medicine, the drugs to kill the germs, the vaccines that are supposed to prevent the germ diseases. So everything is built on this premise that the biological machine, so to speak, of the human body can be overwhelmed by germs, and it doesn't really matter who the person is. If you're standing in the way of a germ, then you're going to get sick. Now, there's a rival theory to that, which on the fringes has existed for a very long time, and that is that it's really all about the immune system of the individual. That germs mostly only take hold and cause illness when the immune system is already compromised, because the immune system is set up to handle germs, to scout them out, to identify them, to reject them, to take care of them, and ward them off. And after investigating so-called epidemics for the last 25 years or so, almost 30 now, and interviewing a great many people who were supposed to be ill or dying or going to die or going to get ill because of the diagnosis that was laid upon them, but still remained healthy. And because of other factors in my research, my conclusion is that it's all about the immune system. That germs, in fact, are not the primary reason for illness at all. And I remember a very important interview that I did with an American molecular biologist. We were talking about certain parts of Africa and Asia and Latin America and so forth. And I pointed out to him, as I had written in my first book on HIV called AIDS Inc., that chronic conditions existed already in Africa for decades, maybe even centuries in certain places, that were destroying people's immune systems and had absolutely nothing to do with germs.
Yeah.
You know, extreme poverty, contaminated water supplies, sewage running in the streets, vast overcrowding, starvation, protein, calorie, malnutrition, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, yes, absolutely, that's right. He said, what happens is a germ will come along and sweep through a population like that, and then it's given a label, it's called an epidemic. But what's really happening is that the people are so weak and debilitated and their immune systems are so badly compromised that that's why it's really happening.
Yes.
It's not happening basically because of the germ. And so that's where I would begin this discussion.
Very, very important points. And when we hear about an epidemic that's current and we're told, you know, a certain number of people have died, thousands of people have died of this particular illness, or as they say now, 10,000 people have now been infected with Ebola. You know, it sounds like a big number. But then, of course, we know that diseases like malaria and dengue fever are absolutely rampant in Africa. And the death toll from those diseases is astronomical, isn't it? I mean, it's way, way beyond anything that Ebola has done.
Yes, and when you start to look at that fact, then you begin to see how publicity, propaganda, statements from medical authorities and governments, really, and public health agencies, especially like the World Health Organization and the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control in the U.S., how this propaganda really shapes the perception of the public.
Yeah.
Because, you know, why not call malaria a threatening worldwide pandemic and say that people who are traveling to Africa could be bringing it home with them, or dengue fever, or look at the World Health Organization statistics on ordinary seasonal flu. The claim is by the World Health Organization that every year there are between 3 and 5 million cases of the flu around the world, which kill between 250,000 and 500,000 people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you would say, well, why don't they announce that as a pandemic?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a germ-caused disease. But here we're talking about a purported number of 10,000 cases and perhaps, I don't know, 6,000 deaths. And all of a sudden, it's a global pandemic. Or take the case of swine flu, where in the spring of 2009, based on 20 cases of swine flu, supposedly 20 cases, which we could even question that number, in the World Health Organization declared a level 6 pandemic, which is their highest category of danger. You know, so
yeah.
We have to look at this and understand it very clearly, that the statements and the propaganda and the fear mongering and so forth are really what this is all about, not the numbers of cases which are pronounced by public health agencies.
Yes, and of course now amid this frenzy, they're saying that that they're going to have to rush a vaccine through. And I was watching some news stories last night, and they were saying that the biggest barrier now to the development of the vaccine is that the vaccine manufacturers require an indemnity. And right at the moment, there is a big legal wrangling going on with the vaccine manufacturers to ensure that they get an indemnity, because they're going to have to bypass the normal testing procedures that they do when they roll out a vaccine. And, you know, isn't that fascinating that that they're actually there admitting that, that possibly a lot of people are going to be injured by the vaccine that they're going to rush out to deal with this?
Yes, well, this is happening now in Australia.
This was actually on the BBC last night. Yeah, it was. I can't remember the exact companies that were engaged in it, but I know that that at the moment they are basically trying to secure the indemnity.
Well, in the US, I can tell you that as of 1986, all vaccine manufacturers have indemnity. That is,
right.
No one who is injured as a result of a vaccine or killed and then the family wants to sue, no one can sue a vaccine company directly.
Yeah.
They have to go through a government system of compensation. And that deal was cooked up between vaccine manufacturers and the U.S. government, because the manufacturers came to the U.S. government in the 80s and said, look, we're going to get out of the vaccine business because there are too many lawsuits. And so we stand to lose more money than we make on the sale of the vaccines.
Yeah.
And so if we can't make an arrangement, then bye-bye. And so an arrangement was made and a law was passed. And I can tell you from much research and many interviews that the compensation for victims of vaccine injury in the United States, that system, that government system, is a nightmare. You have to go through so many different channels and make so many different statements and provide so much evidence, which is always up for challenge by the government. And they are challenging on every possible front to say, well, okay, for example, your son developed autism. So he is developmentally disabled. He doesn't speak. He's away from the world. He's completely introverted. And this happened right after he received the DTaP vaccine. But now, you see, you're going to have to prove that this vaccine caused autism. And we can discuss that further.
Absolutely. We're just going to break. I'm talking to my guest today, John Rappaport. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Men and women of Earth, may I have your attention? This is Hereward Fenton, host of Truth News Radio Australia. You're invited to join the info war as we work to restore truth in media and challenge the dark forces which now dominate mainstream news. I'm calling on you, valued listener, to use your hard-earned dollars to help us smash the globalist empire. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe today. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, talking to John Rappaport, an author on topics about health, disease, illness, viruses, and questions about what really causes disease. And of course, John is a critic of vaccines as well. And, you know, all of these things interlock when we have such a huge money-making industry involved in collaboration with governments under insurance systems or government healthcare systems such as we have in Australia. There is just fantastic amounts of money being made. And, of course, in the Australian system, John, we have a universal healthcare system, so we don't directly pay for vaccines, but, of course, we pay for it through a very, very heavy tax levy. So, you know, when people talk about our healthcare system as being so wonderful because we get all this stuff for free, my response to that is typically that, well, actually, first of all, we don't get it for free. You are paying for it and it's quite expensive. Secondly, you're getting stuff that you probably don't really want or need. They're pushing stuff on you that is not, it's not really the best direction that healthcare should be going in. It's just, it's convenient for them because they have a mechanism to sell products. And it's more about selling products than dealing with issues that are very important about health.
Of course. And not only that, but depending upon which country you're talking about with these universal health plans, there is a certain amount of pressure put on people to accept the diagnosis that they're given and to take the drugs and the vaccines and so forth. And my prediction up the road is that what we're going to see globally is that if the patient begins to become resistant, so, you know, I don't really want this drug because I've done some research on it and it's actually quite toxic. Or, no, I don't want my child to have the full schedule of vaccines.
Yeah.
Now that patient is going to be tagged in the system as resistant, non-compliant, and so forth and so on. And eventually the patient could be kicked out of the system or penalized in other ways. Even if you want to look at the nightmare scenario up the road, criminal charges could be brought against the patient. And in fact, you don't even have to go up the road. What happens now if a parent says, okay, I'm in the system, but I don't want my child to get any vaccines at all because I think that they're dangerous and they're toxic. Now that parent could be red flagged and get a visit from whatever you call it, social worker, child services, protection, et cetera, and the claim is that the parent is endangering the health of the child, and therefore the child could be removed from the parent and put into foster care.
Absolutely.
This is a level of threat.
This has happened in Australia, John. It doesn't happen that often, but it has happened. There have been cases where the Department of Community Services has intervened, and it generally happens when at the hospital, when a parent refuses to get a vaccine for a newborn. Quite often newborns are given vaccines because the parent might be a carrier of a certain virus. I think Hep B, one of the hepatitis carriers, the hospital quite often says, well, this newborn needs to have a vaccine right away. And there have been cases where parents have said, well, no, we don't want to do that. And then the hospital will report them to child protection services. And there have been cases, and it's really quite traumatic. You know, usually now the parents can win out, but it's often a very, very difficult struggle, and it puts them under a huge amount of pressure, and there is the threat that their child could be taken away from, and those threats are made very, very deliberately and very brazenly by the people who work for these authorities.
Absolutely. You know, in the case of Ebola, getting back to that,
yeah.
What people have to understand is there is no such thing as a case of Ebola unless there is a diagnostic test for Ebola.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, that is something that I've been pounding on in articles, and more and more people are beginning to understand this obvious fact. you know, you if you say, oh, there are now 6,000 cases or 12,000 cases or whatever, what does that imply? Well, it implies that some kind of diagnostic test for the Ebola virus, which is purported to be the cause of Ebola, that some kind of diagnostic test has been performed. And so the first thing that I do, because I've been at this for a long time, whenever they announce a new pandemic and this is and that, and blah, 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 is I look to see, okay, what are the standard diagnostic tests that are being run in order to make this assessment that a person has Ebola? And in this case, there are two kinds of tests which I have looked at many times before and found them to be utterly unreliable, useless, and irrelevant in making that diagnosis. Now, that comes as a shock to many people because then they say, well, that couldn't be.
Yeah.
Because if that were the case, then we wouldn't know who has Ebola or if this is really a real epidemic. And I say, bingo, that's right. And as shocking as this may seem, you have to consider it. And in fact, as I've spelled out in great detail about these tests, here's why they're useless, irrelevant, and completely deceptive. And that changes the game completely. Because,
yeah.
Okay, so who's saying that these people have Ebola? On what basis? And particularly, who is saying that the people who are coming back from Africa to the U.S., to Spain, and maybe a couple of other places, actually have Ebola? Because, you see, that's the way this is being promoted as a real global epidemic. Because some people will admit, okay, well, you know, maybe they're making mistakes in diagnosis in West Africa because they have a very primitive medical system and so on. And yes, we understand that there are horrendous conditions there that make people sick all the time and kill them, and that the symptoms of these chronic conditions in these countries, yeah, that they do look and sound like Ebola. Oh, yeah, I guess we could. But the people who come to Dallas, the people who are coming to New York or to Atlanta, I mean, they're doing state-of-the-art testing there. So if these people have Ebola, we know that it's real and that it is dangerous and it's coming to America.
Yes.
But in fact, in America, the same diagnostic tests are being run. And these tests are just simply ridiculous, frankly, from a scientific point of view, completely and utterly ridiculous.
I'd like to talk more about the tests in the next segment. I just want to actually briefly address the issue of the two nurses, because the two nurses who have allegedly come down with Ebola have pushed this into the stratosphere as a kind of news topic, and it is what has facilitated this becoming really now considered to be a very, very serious issue, because we've been told that these two nurses who were following all the correct procedures, they were in hospital, you know, they were obviously trained and they should have been doing whatever they need to do not to get sick. But two nurses became sick. But what I want to look at is, what are these nurses really sick? I mean, how sick are they? I've got a couple of articles that I prepared that I found that described what happened. And both of the nurses actually had reported very, very low-grade fever. And I'll just return to that after we come back from the break. But the nurses had reported a low-grade fever of 99.5 degrees. Now, that is only 1 degree above normal. We're just going to break. I'm talking to John Rappaport, and we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm talking to John Rappaport about Ebola and various aspects of this illness and viral illnesses in general. John, the point I was making earlier there was that the two nurses were both reported as having a temperature of 99.5 degrees. Now, that is only 1 degree above normal. Now, women in the normal menstrual cycle actually have a slightly elevated temperature every month. It is not even a fever. It is a complete furphy to call a temperature of 99.5 degrees a fever. But what I don't know, because it hasn't been reported on, was what happened after that, because that was the only information that was actually reported to the media. Then they were taken in for treatment, and it now says they're getting better. Now, another point to make is that the threshold for suspected Ebola was actually lowered already from 101.5 degrees to 100.4 degrees. They lowered it. The CDC, in their wisdom, decided to lower the threshold. But now, because of these two women becoming sick, they're actually suggesting they're going to lower the threshold still further, down to 99.5 degrees, which is not even... It's actually completely within the normal range. I mean, it is 1 degree above absolute normal, but that range is, normal, to have a variability. The question, which I'm very curious about, is how sick are these women? Did they develop Ebola symptoms? And another point to make about Ebola symptoms is that Ebola symptoms are actually indistinguishable from many, many other illnesses, including malaria. And as we know, malaria is endemic in Africa. And the people who were allowed to come through that had Ebola, or it was some of the people that had been previously diagnosed as malaria, have now been diagnosed as Ebola. But the point to make is that the symptoms of Ebola are indistinguishable from many other illnesses. And so we've then really only got the PCR test, which I'll get you to talk about in a minute, to supposedly prove that they have Ebola. And the other point is our image of what we think of as Ebola is about people bleeding from all their orifices. But apparently that only happens in a minority of cases, and it only happens in the extreme form, late Ebola. And as I understand it, many people who have Ebola will never actually have those symptoms.
Okay, so that's all correct, everything that you're saying. And let's put it this way. I have seen in several instances of various diseases, the definition is expanded so that many more people fit under the umbrella of the diagnosis in terms of their symptoms. That's phase one. And in this phase, that catapults the number of cases. Well, and then you get the blurring of lines between so-called suspected cases and probable cases and definite cases. And this all gets lumped together eventually. Then, when they introduce the treatment or the prevention, the vaccine or whatever, they tighten up the definition again.
Yeah.
And this produces the illusion of a lowering number of cases. And then they say, well, you see, the treatment has been successful. Now, I interviewed a public health officer in the United States in Illinois, Dr. Herbert Ratner, who was retired at the time, and he told me what happened in the case of polio in the U.S. in 1954. First of all, the Infantile Paralysis Association was paying doctors all over the U.S. $25 for every diagnosis of polio. That, in modern terms, is $222.71. Secondly, it was well known that about half of all cases of paralytic polio cured themselves within 60 days without any treatment whatsoever. The person, whatever the paralysis was, went away. Okay, so
yeah.
in the definition expanding phase, the definition of polio was, well, let's put it this way. When they shrank the definition of polio, they said that the paralytic phase had to exist longer than 60 days. Well, that immediately plummeted the number of cases. And they attributed this to the vaccine, when in fact it had nothing to do with the vaccine at all. It just had to do with the covert changing of the definition. And in fact, there were outbreaks of polio in several areas of the United States that coincided with the introduction of the vaccine, where there had been no polio before. So you begin to paint a different picture when you look at the facts. And in the case of these nurses, absolutely, there's nothing to indicate that 99.5, or I don't care what it is, 103, has anything to do necessarily with Ebola. You know, you can eat some bad food at a restaurant and have fever, vomiting, diarrhea, you know, and all of a sudden you've got three symptoms of Ebola. So it all comes down to what is the diagnostic test? That's the, you know, where the rubber meets the road.
Absolutely. So let's start talking about the diagnostic test. Tell us what you know about that, John. Thanks.
Okay, well, there are two. One is called an antibody test. The other, which is the one that's being trumpeted, is the PCR test, the polymerase chain reaction test. This was invented by a PhD biochemist in the U.S. named Carrie Mullis, who won a Nobel Prize for it. And what you do is you go in there with a patient and you take a tiny, tiny, tiny fleck of material tissue sample from the patient. You presume that this is a piece of genetic material from a virus that is far too small to be observed. And you then, through the PCR, many steps, you amplify it millions of times so that you can then observe it. Okay, so first of all, many, many things can go wrong in the procedure, which is highly sensitive. And it's been shown that many times the technicians believe that they have taken a tissue sample or a sample of genetic material from a virus from the patient, but there's absolutely no evidence that that's what they have. They could have a piece of random debris from the patient that has nothing to do with a virus or has nothing to do with the virus that they're looking for. So in that case, the test is completely invalid, right? Now, assuming that the test is done perfectly, all you know from that would be that the patient came in contact with an incredibly tiny amount of a particular virus, far too small an amount to cause any human illness whatsoever. Because in order to cause human illness, you need millions and millions of an active virus operating in the body to even begin to say that that virus might be causing the person to become sick.
Yes, can we just emphasize that? Sorry to interrupt, but can we just emphasize that for a moment? Is that the concept of testing for a virus, most people think that they're going to look in your blood and they're going to say, oh, there's a whole lot of virus in your blood. And in many cases, that is the case. Correct me if I'm wrong. But in the case of Ebola, they're not using that technique. They're using this amplification technique. And one must ask, well, why do they have to amplify? Why can't they just find it in the blood?
Exactly. Okay, now actually, there are problems with, you know, all diseases when you use the PCR, but we're concentrating here on Ebola. In other words, exactly as you say, why did they have to do that test? Because if the person was just alive with, you know, and crawling with Ebola virus, there are direct methods, which is really what you need, to extract and isolate and purify that virus and then discover how much of it is in the body directly rather than through this indirect method, which shows you absolutely nothing.
Absolutely. We're going to break. We'll be right back with Truth News Radio Australia. Really interesting topic today. Don't go away. Talking about Ebola with John Rappaport, who has written a lot about this, and his site, if you're interested, is nomorefakenews.com, and that has his blog on there and links to various work that John has done. Now, we were just talking there about this concept of testing for viruses, and I raised the question of why is it that that we cannot find large amounts of Ebola virus in the blood. I mean, is that a valid question? Is that a correct assumption to make, John? Because I mean, we could segue into talking about AIDS here, but we don't really have enough time. But just briefly, for our listeners, the use of this technique for testing for viruses was pioneered in AIDS research when it was used to detect HIV virus, which is otherwise largely undetectable in human blood or lymph. So I'll just hand it over to you to expand on that, John.
Well, yes, that's the case. And in fact, in Australia, you have the Perth group of scientists who have challenged the PCR method with HIV because they're basically saying there is no evidence that the initial tiny sample taken from a person is actually HIV or a piece of HIV, because there is no evidence that, that HIV was ever isolated and purified in the first place. And they make a very persuasive argument. So now here we are with Ebola. Well, you know, it's pretty clear. Even by conventional medical standards, you have to be saying that there's a whole lot of virus in somebody's body in order to begin to say that the virus has some connection to why the person is ill. Why are you using a test in which you only start with some sort of microscopic fleck of material? Because you can test for it directly. You should be able to isolate it and purify it, and also test for what's called titer, which basically means how much of the virus is in the body. Now, these are also complicated tests to some degree, but no more complicated than the PCR. And this is the kind of test that you obviously want to do, because you're talking about the promotion of a global pandemic here, and you want to get it right.
Yes.
But they're not getting it right. And so the whole thing is thrown into complete doubt because, you know, where is the burden of proof? The burden of proof is on the people who say there is an outbreak and it's very infectious and contagious and it's coming to other countries, blah, blah, blah. Well, they're the ones who are saying it. So let's see the evidence, the real evidence, not just the doctors in white coats appearing on television and blabbing and trying to, you know, hype up the idea.
Yes, and it's very interesting also that the epidemic hasn't really expanded in Africa. For example, in Nigeria, one would have thought there would have been a rampant epidemic in Nigeria by now, but they've now declared Nigeria is free of Ebola. So just an interesting observation there that it doesn't quite... They're saying, well, that proves that the protection measures that they used worked, you know, because they've been border controls. But I mean, that's just such a ludicrous proposition. I mean, with the number of people that are moving back and forth through African countries, to think that they would actually be able to stop the spread of this disease, and when there actually had been reported cases of Ebola already in Nigeria, is just absurd. The other thing I wanted to point out, John, is that the test, the diagnostic test, as I understand it, it's not particularly cheap. And why is this important? Well, in countries like Liberia and Sierra Leone, I doubt whether they're using this PCR test on every single case. I have extreme doubt as to whether they would be able to afford to do that.
Of course, of course. And let me tell you, from my experience with other so-called epidemics, most of the diagnosis that's taking place, at the, quote, center, is eyeball diagnosis.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is. In fact, that happened in the United States with swine flu. They stopped, the CDC stopped counting numbers in the summer of 2009. Now, people would walk into clinics, they walk into hospitals and this and that, they have a few symptoms. And so the doctor says Ebola or swine flu or whatever the current, fad happens to be. That's the way most diagnosis is actually done. No tests whatsoever. So, and then when we're talking about the diagnostic tests, or the PCR, yes, very expensive. A big industry, by the way.
Yeah.
A big industry, selling the machines, doing the tests, the companies, the lab techs, et cetera, et cetera. This is an industry in and of itself that promotes itself. So there's that aspect of it, too.
So it may well be that these 10,000 people in West Africa are ill, but that they may have simply malaria or dengue, dengue is a viral hemorrhagic fever. It's in the same class as Ebola. It's a very, very similar illness, and it can cause very similar symptoms. So what are we really looking at? And of course, people will say, you don't know because you're not an expert.
But, yeah. Let me just broaden the perspective here.
Yeah.
Instead of just saying, it could be malaria or dengue fever, years of debilitating war, displacing who knows how many people, huge numbers of people, we're talking in West Africa, sewage in the streets, unclean drinking water, in certain sectors of Liberia, heavy industrial pollution from Firestone rubber plantation, fish dying in the streams, people drinking the water, people dying. Generation to generation starvation, malnutrition, lack of protein in the diet, huge overcrowding, huge numbers of people living in very close quarters, the wide, vast use of antibiotics that are highly toxic, available over the counter, also in anti-diarrheal medicines, which is another leading cause of death in the third world, diarrhea, which means just incredible amounts of loss of body fluids and minerals and so forth, a direct result of malnutrition. we begin to add all of these up. The vast overuse of antibiotics causes bleeding, internal bleeding, which is the major cause of vomiting blood.
Wow.
The huge use of organophosphate pesticides in sectors of West Africa, in Liberia, for example, that are sprayed indoors in homes and clinics and wherever against mosquitoes. And these are some of the most toxic pesticides that exist, and they too cause bleeding. So you're talking about death and dying from all of these factors, and add in malaria, add in whatever you want to. And now you're going to say, we know that these 10,000 people out of this hugely suffering population have Ebola. And we're doing it mainly by eyeball diagnosis. It's completely absurd. Completely absurd.
Yeah.
It has no basis in fact whatsoever. And then on top of that, you say, and the diagnostic test that we're doing is very accurate, which is a total lie. So, that's what we're looking at.
And the rescue, the wonderful thing that that the UN is going to now do is they're going to rush through this vaccine. There's going to be a huge expense of money developing the vaccine, getting boots on the ground. We've got actually literally the Marines in Africa now, it's a military exercise as well to fight Ebola, and they're going to bring in a vaccine. And of course, the vaccine is going to do other untold damage. We don't know, but every other vaccine has caused so many problems. And you know, John, I'd love to get you on this show again because I would like to talk to you about some of the deeper agendas that are at work here. And I know that this is something that you're very interested in, is to understand what is really going on here. I mean, a lot of us look at it and acknowledge it, but we just can't figure out why it's happening. Why is there this malevolent attack on humanity from a tiny concentration of power of elites who run these large organizations, companies, pharmaceutical industry, and many, many other corporations? Why are they doing this? I mean, it's so hard for a rational person who's not mentally disturbed or doesn't have some sort of personality disorder to understand the motives that are going with this enormous deceit that's being perpetrated on us.
I'd be glad to come on and talk about that. In fact, I was just starting to think about, you know, that's the other piece of this. Why is this happening? What are the agendas, you know, and so forth? And I've spent a great deal of time and effort researching that, and we can certainly talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, from the perspective of a normal person, we cannot imagine how people could act in such a malevolent way to humanity. And I think that is why the cognitive dissonance kicks in for most people who look at questions about vaccine safety or many of these really serious issues like AIDS and HIV, because they just can't think that we would be lied to in such a degree because it's so evil. I mean, just briefly in the last minute, just a quick point on that.
Well, look, in West Africa, you've got mineral wealth, huge mineral wealth. You've got very fertile farmland in certain areas. And we're talking about corporate takeover, financial takeover on every level of these societies. And one of the ways that you take over and maintain control of a society is you make sure that the people are too weak to resist and rebel. That's why these chronic conditions continue to exist in these countries, because the people who rule them and the outside financiers...
John, we'll have to cut it off there. So sorry. We're at the end of the hour. Thank you so much for today. We'll have you on again.
Okay, it's a deal.
Okay, thanks a lot. Truth News Radio Australia signing out. See you next week.